Hi, this is Gordon Deal. The Wall Street Journal This Weekend starts right after this.
Hi, I'm Lex Friedman. I run my own business called Podlexing. So I know from experience, hiring new employees can be tough. With so many job boards out there, how can you know which one will produce the best talent? Realistically, to fill the position fast and with the perfect candidate, you need to post your job on all the top job sites. And now you can do it with a single click with ZipRecruiter.com. ZipRecruiter.com lets you post to more than 40 job sites at once. ZipRecruiter.com also posts your job on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter. Just post once and watch the qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. You can screen applicants, rate them, and hire the right people fast. Try ZipRecruiter free right now and find out why it's been used by over 100,000 businesses. And right now, listeners of this program can try ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/WSJ. That's ZipRecruiter.com/WSJ. One more time, to try ZipRecruiter for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/WSJ.
Direct from the newsroom of the Wall Street Journal, The Wall Street Journal This Weekend with Gordon Deal.
Why Brazilians are losing faith. I'm Gordon Deal with Gina Cervetti. Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up during this program.
The promise of a World Cup soccer tournament bringing an economic boost to the host country is fading. We'll explain why.
On the tech front, how much would you pay for a certain bathroom fixture? Hear about the man who wants to be the Steve Jobs of toilets.
On TV, AMC is making a bet on its own programming. We'll preview the new show Halt and Catch Fire, which debuts on Sunday evening.
And five food additives that will make you grimace more than pink slime.
A lot of foods flavored with vanilla, cookies and cakes, sweets flavored with vanilla. This is really gross. I'm warning everyone. They're often made from secretions from a beaver's behind.
Market Watch reporter Katie Hill. Can't make that up. On other surprising origins for food additives, she's here in about 10 minutes. How influential can TV news be during an election year? For the past year, Egypt's six major news channels have been openly criticizing the Muslim Brotherhood. That's been a serious boost to presidential hopeful Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. To Cairo now, and Wall Street Journal reporter Matt Bradley is with us on the T-Mobile hotline. Matt, what are you hearing?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I was told by some of these media personalities was that they basically decided altogether at a meeting shortly before President Morsi was toppled, that they would be referring to the organization as a terrorist group. And I think that from my own observations here in Egypt, that was a really pivotal moment because you started to see a change in the dialogue surrounding an organization that the Egyptian public had just elected only a year ago. And not only that, they elected President Morsi, but they had elected Brotherhood officials or Brotherhood positions in multiple referendums and elections over the past 3 years. So this was a group that the Egyptian public felt very comfortable voting into office, and suddenly not only were they rallying around calling him and his and the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist organization, but they were defending and in some cases cheering them being killed in the streets, and we saw more than 1,000 of them killed in various riots since July 3rd when Morsi was ousted.
What prompted the meeting in which these TV news directors got together and decided to call the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist organization?
Well, the circumstances surrounding this meeting was that there was a sustained protest outside this sort of suburban office park called Media City here in Cairo, where a lot of these stations have their headquarters. And this protest was called by members of the Muslim Brotherhood, by a strong, very sort of fundamentalist Islamist group of Egyptians who call themselves Salafis. And they essentially laid siege to this office park for several weeks, complaining about the fact that these media people had not been representing the president's position in the run-up to these June 30th protests against Morsi's rule, and that they had been stoking anger against the Brotherhood.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Matt Bradley in Cairo about how Egyptian TV swayed the public against former President Mohamed Morsi. Explain the lengths that some of these TV anchors and reporters went to paint that picture of the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist group.
Well, one of the interesting things that I heard when speaking to one of the producers for a channel known as CBC he told me that he was actually in the United States around the time of the September 11th attacks, and that he took his cues from his memory of what American television stations had done at the time. He decided that he was going to try the same approach here in Egypt, where he would put a standing banner that said the word of Egyptians, the Egyptian people, against extremism. And that just stayed on television for a couple of days until he changed it to Egyptians against terrorism. And a lot of these standing banners looked very similar to what was being done in the United States after September 11th and among the different channels. And some of the channel heads told me that, yeah, they had coordinated this. They decided that they were going to be using this very type of language. And then when the narrative started to diverge between the foreign media and the Egyptian media, many Egyptian media personalities were offended by the foreign media coverage, and so they decided to reach out in English to Westerners. And that's when, at least on TV, decided to dub a lot of their broadcasts into English so that viewers could choose if they wanted to hear a dubbed English version of what was being reported on TV. So it was they went to extreme lengths to be able not only to express their opinion to Egyptians here, but even to try to reach out to Americans and Westerners with the message that they were fighting terrorism here in Egypt, and this was a noble goal.
Did the Muslim Brotherhood protest being called terrorists on TV?
Yes, but we have to remember that at the time the Muslim Brotherhood were being rounded up. They were being arrested. There's now something like some groups estimated more than 30,000 Morsi sympathizers and protesters in favor of Morsi have been rounded up and arrested. The Muslim Brotherhood leadership were almost entirely rounded up and arrested. And after that July 3rd, and after this decision to call the Brotherhood terrorists, none of these personalities ever made it onto these private channels. And, of course, we have to remember that in the 3 years leading up to this, Muslim Brotherhood members and supporters had been constant fixtures on many of these channels, and they were able to give their opinion quite freely because they were in government and they were powerful. They had the votes among the public. So this was a really dramatic change of tone and just perspective, because Brotherhood officials weren't even really giving their opinion.
Well, thanks, Matt. That's Wall Street Journal reporter Matt Bradley, who's based in Cairo. 12 minutes now after the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Hey, Gletch, with us on this final weekend of May. Does the thought of eating pink slime give you the willies? That, believe it or not, may not be the grossest food additive available, according to MarketWatch reporter Katie Hill, who has a list of even more disgusting ingredients. Katie, set this up.
Pink slime, as everyone probably has been reading in the news, is making a big comeback, so prepare for that in your meat. But yeah, these are even grosser, and people don't know about them. So the first one is a lot of foods flavored with vanilla, cookies and cakes, sweets flavored with vanilla. This is really gross. I'm warning everyone. They're often made from secretions from a beaver's behind. So apparently, this is true. I couldn't even make this up if I tried. I was disturbed when I learned this. But often on a package of cookies or cakes where there's vanilla flavoring, it'll say something like natural flavoring. Mm-hmm. It doesn't even have to label this stuff.
You know what's fascinating about it is that the process that somebody actually discovered this, right?
No.
How did that happen? I don't know.
I don't know. And when I learned this, I almost just closed down my computer. Yeah. And I was like, I'm not sure if I can learn any more about how gross this
right.
is.
Pass the chocolate, please.
Right. Yeah. Like, no, I will not be eating vanilla ice cream cone this summer.
Man.
At least, most of it's not made from, most vanilla flavored things are safe from this. It's still a small minority of foods, but this has been used for vanilla flavoring for 80 years. So all of us have probably eaten it at some point, mm-hmm. even though it's a small minority of vanilla-flavored foods.
Wow. What else is on the list?
Pulverized beetles.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of red-flavored food is made from pulverized beetles. You'll see it on the ingredients list, though, so if you want to avoid this, it's usually called carmine or carminic acid or one of kind of a derivative of one of those words, but it's made from, they sort of grind up beetles, these bright red beetles, and dye the food that way.
All right.
Mm.
Please continue. This is wonderful.
Grossing everybody out today. Mm-hmm. Okay, so another food additive that you probably didn't really know about, human and rodent hair. So human hair, this surprised me, is added to a lot of breads and baked goods to prolong their shelf life. And then rodent hair, this is for another reason, but rodent hair ends up in food because the FDA allows a certain amount of what they call defects in food. And one of those is rodent hair. So sometimes that just ends up in your food. And that's an accident, whereas the human hair is on purpose.
We're speaking with Market Watch reporter Katie Hill. She's got a story about five food additives even grosser than pink slime. It's hard to argue them. Secretions from a beaver's behind, number one. Crushed or pulverized beetles. We've got human and rodent hair. What else?
This one is perhaps most disturbing to me, not because of its grossness, even though it's totally gross, but just because it's in so many beers and wines. Fish bladders. So ground up fish bladders are added to beer and wine because for some reason it makes it clearer. So sometimes when they first make the beer or the wine, it's kind of murkier. And this somehow, I'm no scientist, but this clears it up. So it's a little more of like a kind of uniform consistency.
Again, one of those things, who and how did somebody figure out that a fish bladder could somehow make the appearance of wine and beer clearer?
You know how someone has a lot more time on their hands than we do, yeah. I think. But yeah, I mean, so it's interesting because a lot of vegetarians drink wine and beer not realizing that this is there and it's not vegetarian.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. And finally,
This one's delicious. Maggots and insect eggs. And now they're in your food for the same reason that rodent hair is. The FDA allows a certain amount of defects to go in food. And apparently a defect is a maggot or an insect egg is totally fine. I mean, there can't be a ton of them, but a few of them in your fruits or your vegetables are all right. Even your spices, those are called defects, and the FDA allows them.
Well, that's a new take on food, is it not? Market Watch reporter Katie Hill, who's based in New York. 20 minutes now after the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. It's time now for Gina Cervetti.
Okay, well, the first week of June brings a number of economic reports, including the government's look at May employment. Dr. Vincent Malanga at LaSalle Economics says he expects to see around 200,000 new jobs for May, down from April.
I think there was some weather-related shifts in employment that took place in the January through March period, and I think that was recouped in April, plus we had a late Easter.
And we also get separate reports assessing both the non-manufacturing and the manufacturing parts of our economy in the coming week. Consumer spending is going down, falling by 0.1% in April. Now, that was the largest amount in a year. Meanwhile, our incomes edged higher but marked the year's smallest gain, and we put away more money with the savings rate rising to 4% of our incomes. The revised look at first quarter economic growth was even worse than initially projected, with the economy's first contraction in about 3 years in the first quarter. Activity shrank by almost 1%, or it was 1% actually. And the journal's Sarah Portlock says this does not happen much outside of recessions.
It's a rare thing. It's only happened about a handful of times to actually contract outside of a recession dating back to 1947, which is when the Commerce Department first has this data available.
The Chevy Impala is the only non-luxury vehicle to earn the highest safety rating in new tests of collision warning and automatic braking systems. Other vehicles earning a superior from the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety were the BMW 5 Series, the Mercedes-Benz E-Class, Buick Regal, two Cadillac models, and the 2015 Hyundai Genesis. A group of leading scientists is warning the World Health Organization not to classify e-cigarettes as tobacco. 53 researchers from North America, Europe, and elsewhere argue that what they call low-risk products like e-cigarettes are an important part of trying to combat smoking, and that classifying it as tobacco would jeopardize, they say, a major opportunity to slash disease and deaths. All right, well, you may not think of Starbucks for burgers, but maybe you did not know that Starbucks owns a San Francisco area chain called La Boulange. When it expands in L.A. soon, it will include burgers as part of a dinner menu. Starbucks has been experimenting with various ways to expand beyond selling coffee-focused beverages, as you may know.
See, but in my mind, I associate now coffee with a burger, and I don't see that pairing.
Oh.
So I have to change my mindset
yeah.
to think, well, I'm not going to get coffee if I'm going to go into a Starbucks-related chain and get a burger. So,
well, I'm sure they'll have something else that you can pair with your burger, Gordon, if you happen to travel to L.A. and sit down at the table and dine.
I'm willing to try anything, I guess, when it comes to food. Thank you, Gina. 23 minutes after the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. As you've probably heard, Google has developed the first driverless car prototype. In a promotional video, it's shown as a two-seater that the Journal says resembles a gondola on wheels. Not exactly eye candy. Where do we go from here with this? A look ahead from tech analyst Rob Enderle, who's based in San Jose. Rob, what do we have here?
This is their latest iteration. It's not the most attractive car I've ever seen. Think of a smart car with a radar dish on top of it, and you're probably pretty close. This is a two-seat people mover. It's designed to move in and through cities, which is where they're doing a lot of the testing right now, and certainly would be very affordable, but but it would be hard not to look incredibly geeky by driving one of these things.
No steering wheel, no gas pedal, no brake pedal. Does that make you nervous?
Well, a little bit. If something goes wrong, I mean, typically with a self-driving car, if it gets confused, it hands over control to you. But if you don't have a brake, a steering wheel, or any control whatsoever, that's not going to do you a whole heck of a lot of good. But I mean, think of this like an elevator. You get in, you push a button, and you go. If for whatever reason the system stops working in an elevator or in a car, you're pretty much going to be in the same screwed condition.
We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle about Google's driverless car. Any idea how advanced they'll be? For example, like, you know, you and I can use the steering wheel sometimes to avoid something that might appear in the road, whether it's an animal or a big pothole that, you know, that appeared that's not on anybody's, you know, mapping system, for example. Will the car sense that, or do they hope it will at some point?
Well, it's running on a LiDAR system, so it's a very enhanced form of laser sensor, and it senses potholes, it senses stuff in your way. It can actually see better, for the most part, than you can, because it sees 360 degrees all the time. So it can see something approaching from the side, something approaching from the rear, and it never gets distracted, so it's not going to be checking its email or the young lady that's walking by in the street on the driver's side of the door. It stays focused on driving 100% of the time and on all directions. So, yeah, in general, it's going to be much more aware than you are. Your only issue, of course, is if someone were to hack into the system and take control of it, or if the system were to crash or fail. And, of course, we know that computers almost never crash and fail.
Right. That said, then, who's the ideal customer for Google?
Somebody that lives in the city and may not actually own it, might actually have a service where they share a fleet of cars, then the car picks you up in front of your apartment or condominium or hotel and drives you to where you need to go, much like an elevator.
Thanks, Rob. It's our tech analyst, Rob Enderle, who's based in San Jose, California. It is 30 minutes now after the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. As we said, final weekend period of the month of May. Coming up next, are you shopping for clothes? Hey, ladies, get this. Forget the numerical sizes. We're now into alpha sizing.
We help farmers make the best use of their land, which means healthier crops, higher yields, and less harvesting hours, which is good news for a growing population and good news for the environment. BASF, the chemical company.
How easy is getting unlimited data outside the U.S. with T-Mobile? Just one step. Turn on your phone. Because with T-Mobile, unlimited global data in over 100 countries is automatically included in your plan at no extra charge. Sounds simple? It is simple. It's the Simple Choice for Business plan, only at T-Mobile.
Qualifying service and capable device required. Standard speeds approximately 128 kilobytes per second. No tethering. See T-Mobile.com for full feature terms and included destinations.
Powered by the most trusted name in journalism, you're listening to The Wall Street Journal this weekend.
Thanks for being with us. Gordon Deal with Gina Cervetti. Coming up this half hour, The New Gamble from AMC Networks. Plus, the man who wants to be the Steve Jobs of toilets. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. A growing number of Brazilians are against hosting the World Cup, which they say has done little to improve infrastructure and public services. The big tournament kicks off next month. So much for all that initial hope 7 years ago. We take you now to Sao Paulo, where Wall Street Journal reporter John Lyons is based. John, quite a turnaround.
Yeah, I mean, the World Cup here took on a huge meaning when it was announced back in 2007. I mean, not only was the World Cup coming to the most soccer-mad country on the planet, you know, a place that most soccer fans consider as kind of, you know, holds part of soccer's soul. People compared bringing the cup here as you know, returning the game to its mecca. But, you know, not only as a major sports event, it was also kind of seen as a major economic event because at the time, Brazil was rising to this new level as a developed nation. You know, back in 2007, there was enormous optimism for Brazil's growth. The stock market rose 44% that year. You know, the country was getting bigger position in global forums like the IMF and the G8 and this. But 7 years later, that boom kind of fizzled. You know, the commodity prices that were pushing Brazil's economy dropped, and Brazil was not able to solve some of its economic bottlenecks, you know, crumbling ports and roads and poor educational levels. And, you know, the country's been in an economic slump for the last 4 years, and there's really no end to it in sight. So suddenly this World Cup that is costing the country $11.5 billion has become kind of a symbol of the unfulfilled promises. The people were holding banners like, you know, we want World Cup standard schools, we want World Cup standard hospitals, not these World Cup standard stadiums that were built. So this kind of giant price tag has added, almost has become also an insult in when you look around the rest of the economy and see that other things just didn't improve, from the roads, subways, highways, ports and airports that we're all supposed together to get better.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter John Lyons in Sao Paulo, Brazil. What would you say is the biggest project that was promised but has failed ahead of the World Cup?
Well, kind of the standout, almost comical example is this bullet train, a high-speed train that the Brazilians were hoping to build between Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro by the time of the World Cup. And they had 7 years to plan for the World Cup, but which is a year more than most countries get. And their, you know, due to the optimism at the outset, their initial plans were very, very ambitious. This bullet train was to cost $16 billion, and they would have to tunnel through multiple mountains, you know, on the kind of rugged coast between Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro. So it was a tall order from the outset, squabbling between government agencies over, you know, how much the fares would cost, whether it would be a government-run train or whether it would be private, and, you know, squabbling over even where it would stop on the way to Rio de Janeiro. Wow. Delayed the bidding round for the train so much that by the time they put it out to bid in 2010, it was already too late to actually finish it by the World Cup.
Thanks, John. Wall Street Journal reporter John Lyons from Sao Paulo, Brazil. 22 minutes before the hour now on the Wall Street Journal This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. More clothing across all price tiers is being made in sizes small, medium, and large. Wall Street Journal fashion reporter Elizabeth Holmes says if you browse through the racks at almost any clothing store, chances are you'll see more letters than numbers. Elizabeth, what's trending?
So when you're shopping at your favorite clothing store, you may notice two types of sizing. One is called numeric sizing, which is where they use numbers to sort of differentiate between sizes. And the other is called alpha sizing, which is the industry term for sizes like small, medium, and large. And alpha sizing is on the rise. So at first I thought, well, gosh, does this have to do with the casual trends that we're in right now? And that absolutely is the case. We're sort of in the yoga pantification of America and casual and athleisure wear, which is not necessarily workout wear, but sort of the yoga pant look for running errands. That's very popular right now, and yes, that's leading to that because alpha sizing is a less specific fit, and it often relies on fabrics that have a lot of stretch. And so that makes perfect sense. But digging a little deeper, it turns out that alpha sizing is something that companies really like because it's actually much more financially efficient. So instead of having to make 8 or 12 numerical sizes, they can offer 5 or 6 alpha sizes, still reach the same shopper base and save some money.
Did you say athleisure wear?
Athleisure, yes, that's an industry term.
I was practicing saying that in my head before I actually said it out loud to make sure I got it right. Athleisure wear.
So it's like not workout wear, but it's not sort of standard sportswear. It's more, you know, like very fitted bottoms and oversized tops. And for guys, it's a lot of pants with elastic waistbands.
Got it. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Elizabeth Holmes in New York about the closely guarded sizing secrets that clothing companies have. So this, the sizing secrets now, this is a source of controversy, or it makes things confusing for the shopper, or what?
Well, on one hand, it makes it easier for the shopper because you don't have to sort through every sort of numbered size. For women, that's 0, 2, 4, 6 and up kind of thing. You don't have to sort through that to find your size because or you have a smaller selection from which to choose. And for online shoppers, it's actually easier too because I don't know about you or your wife, but I often order two sizes if I'm not sure which one will fit me and then return the other. That kind of thing happens less online when you're dealing with alpha sizing. So for a lot of customers, it is easier. And psychologically, it's easier, especially for women. Women in the workforce or women who have had children tend to have in their head a size that they think they are. And they do not want to sort of budge from that.
Okay.
And so if I think in my head, I am certain I am a small, then I am more willing to pick up a small in a store. And if it doesn't look like it will fit me, I will walk away rather than size up to a medium.
Oh, is that
so
right?
So it gives the stores a little bit of flexibility. The problems arise, though, with consistency and fit.
Yeah.
Because typically an alpha size is based on a combination of two numerical sizes. So instead of making a size 8 and a size 10 for women, they will make a medium. But the problem is some brands base that medium on a size 8, some base it on a size 10, and some somewhere in between. So okay. I'm sure you've gone shopping at a store and you pick up a medium and you're like, this looks great. And you go to another store and a medium's like, whoa, way too big kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so that can be frustrating from a shopper perspective.
The scenario she painted there is not quite accurate because I don't actually go into a store or shop in general. Wall Street Journal fashion writer Elizabeth Holmes. It's 15 minutes before the hour on the Wall Street Journal This Weekend.
A smartphone is a pretty harmless device, unless you take one outside the U.S. without T-Mobile. Binging quietly on emails and GPS coordinates, it might run your data tab into the thousands. Smart business travelers choose T-Mobile's Simple Choice for Business plan, with unlimited global data in over 100 countries at no extra charge.
Qualifying service and capable device required. Standard speeds approximately 128 kilobytes per second. No tethering. See T-Mobile.com for full feature terms and included destinations.
Glad you're with us. The cable TV channel AMC is betting on its own original shows. That'll be the case Sunday evening when the new drama Halt and Catch Fire will air. More on the corporate strategy from Wall Street Journal reporter Keech Hagee. Keech, what's it about first off?
This Sunday night, AMC is going to be rolling out its newest drama called Halt and Catch Fire, which is set in Dallas in the early 80s amid the PC wars. And it's very similar to the one that we all know, Mad Men. It's normally in that slot in that, you know, it's a period drama. It's kind of a business drama. It has an anti-hero with a mysterious past. But what's really different is that they own this show, whereas before they had just licensed Mad Men from Lionsgate. So they're in a very different financial position than they have been in the past.
So I imagine this is a situation where the risks are bigger, but also the rewards could be bigger.
That's exactly right. And that fact is making investors a little bit nervous. They've had a great run so far. You know, they have three great hits among, you know, the 8 shows they've ever put on the air. So that's really a better batting average than most television executives can boast. But kind of because of that, investors are worried that if they're doubling down so much on owning their own content, you know, a few duds are really going to be painful for the company.
Can you explain how much more expensive this is for AMC rather than, say, buying the show from someone else?
Well, it's a lot about when the actual costs hit your books. If you license a show from a studio, you can amortize the cost of that over 5 years. But if you have your own show, the entire cost of that season hits your books all at one time. So, you know, these kind of fancy shows with costumes and good actors, they run about $3 million an episode, and all of that is being paid by AMC.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Keech Hagee. Does that make it harder to walk away from an unsuccessful show?
That's right. And it's even more complicated by the fact that even if a show doesn't get great ratings, you can always package it up and sell it to Netflix at the end, or sell the DVD, or have other licensing deals. And that's where a lot of the money is going to be coming from in the future for these cable networks increasingly. So even if, you know, things aren't looking good in the first few weeks, you know, their executives say, we're patient because maybe we'll make money down the line.
Explain the profits, Keach, and how much bigger the profits are when done this way.
Well, the way that AMC is hoping that it will go is when they own these shows, and if they do become hits, they're going to be able to be the ones to benefit from the big Netflix deals. You know, Mad Men did a deal with Banana Republic even to make clothes in the theme of Mad Men, and deals like that, which before would have gone largely to the studio, are that all that money would go right to AMC.
Any indication of whether AMC can continue this method of actually owning its own programs?
Well, it's done it a few times. The biggest example is The Walking Dead. That's the first show they ever owned, and that is the most successful show in the history of cable. So, you know, they've had a really good run initially. The question is, when you start to do it over and over again, what are the risks there? And, you know, investors punished them a little bit in the last earnings when they saw that their programming costs were higher than expected. So if that happens over and over again, they could be looking for, they could experience some pain for the market.
Thanks, Keach. Wall Street Journal reporter Keach Hagee. It is 9 minutes now before the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Once again, here is Gina Cervetti.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, the first week of June brings a look back at employment for May. But there are other things to watch for, too, including the Fed's beige book on economic activity in its various districts.
The Federal Reserve will probably continue to say that the economy is growing at a more rapid rate than it had been as we get a rebound from the harsh winter weather. But at best, growth is moderate and nothing to get excited about.
Vincent Malanga with LaSalle Economics. This next week also brings the latest on consumer credit and international trade. A handful of states accounts for almost half of all U.S. foreclosures that were completed over the past year. CoreLogic identifies the states as Florida, Michigan, Texas, California, and Georgia. Overall, the foreclosure picture continues to brighten. In April, there were 46,000 completed foreclosures in the U.S., down from 56,000 in April of last year. Apple is gearing up for its much-anticipated developers conference this next week with a lot of buzz surrounding a new iPhone, smartwatch, and smart appliances and gadgets for the house. The conference follows Apple's recent deal to buy Beats Electronics for $3 billion. What if you could get an insurance payout just because your flight was late? It may be possible with some new insurance that Berkshire Hathaway plans to start offering travelers. The Journal's Scott McCartney fills us in.
It's insurance that is available for domestic trips at a flat fee of $25, and it pays out if something goes wrong. So if your flight is 2 hours late, they'll put $50 into your bank account.
McCartney says this new offer pays out for other reasons, too.
If your check bag doesn't get to you within 12 hours, $500 goes into your account. You miss a connection, boom, $500. Stuck on the plane for a two-hour tarmac delay, they'll pay you $1,000.
Minneapolis has the nation's best park system, as ranked by the Trust for Public Land. The third annual Park Score survey put Minneapolis at the top of a list ranking urban green space for a second straight year. New York ranked second, while Boston, San Francisco, Portland, Oregon tied for third when it comes to the best city greenscapes. Actress Eva Longoria's steakhouse has closed less than 2 years after it opened in a Tony shopping center on the Las Vegas Strip. She by Morton's from parent company Landry featured a catwalk and smaller portion sizes geared toward female customers, along with mirrors on the back of dessert menus designed for patrons to help them reapply their lipstick.
That's funny. I wish she was here right now. I'd give her a nice hug and try to comfort her.
Oh, you're feeling bad.
Yeah, just hold her for 2 or 3 minutes. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. How much would you be willing to pay for the most modern of toilets? The Toto washlet, made in Japan, is wildly popular. The lid lifts automatically. The seat heats up. Built-in bidets make cleanup a breeze. Some of them even sync with your smartphone so that you can program your preferences and play your favorite music through speakers built into the bowl. 3/4 of Japanese homes contain such toilets, most of them made by one of two companies, Toto, Japan's largest maker, or LIXIL. Now, the chief executive of LIXIL plans to add toilets with integrated bidets to the lineup of American Standard brands, which you probably know, which LIXIL bought last year. He says Americans would welcome these toilets into their homes once they see them under a familiar name. His argument, few people realized they needed smartphones until the iPhone came along. Thing is, the price can range up to more than $5,000 for the high-end models, more than 10 times the price of some conventional toilets. For Gina Cervetti, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to the Wall Street Journal This Weekend.
How easy is getting unlimited data outside the U.S. with T-Mobile? Just one step. Turn on your phone. Because with T-Mobile, unlimited global data in over 100 countries is automatically included in your plan at no extra charge. Sounds simple? It is simple. It's the simple choice for business plan, only at T-Mobile.
Qualifying service and capable device required. Standard speeds approximately 128 kilobytes per second. No tethering. See T-Mobile.com for full feature terms and included destinations.
We help farmers make the best use of their land, which means healthier crops, higher yields, and less harvesting hours, which is good news for a growing population and good news for the environment. BASF, the chemical company.